filed a 28-J letter in this case. It's been a Fifth Circuit decision, which is well briefed. The facts are so striking at the same time because they're virtually identical. Both debtors purchased property in 1984, obtained property in 1994. Mr. Green bought his, Ms. Rogers inherited hers. They then both got into relationships. Ms. Rogers got married. Mr. Green moved in with his girlfriend. In approximately 2005, they ran into financial difficulties. Ms. Rogers divorced. Mr. Green got in with his girlfriend and moved out into the property. Ms. Rogers purchased the house Mr. Green had previously purchased and put a travel trailer on the property. He then purchased a prefabricated structure, which at one point someone called a tent, and that figure has been haunting me for years. The structure, however you want to call it, is photographed on page 100 of our canvas over the fabricated structure used in mines. At any rate, both filed bankruptcy in 2005 after owning the property for a decade. In both Nevada and Texas, you need to reside on property that is your home. And they then both ran into the same objections that their home is in cash under 522C1. That provides that if debtor needs any amount of interest that was acquired by the debtor during the 1215-day period. The Fifth Circuit said that the figures any amount of value is quantitative, and that it was referring to equity or title. I prefer to use universally equity in both. And the Fifth Circuit version, as contrasted with Judge Ives' version in our case, where he said what you acquire is the homestead, the Fifth Second version works if you look at the other parts of the section where they use the word interest in the property. For example, or the word interest, it fits with the exceptions, whereas if you try to call the word interest to be your homestead, then you'll have to use a different definition for the exceptions. The exceptions are that the homestead is not capped at $125,000 for the amount of interest you transfer from a previous residence. If you sell your house in the state and use the proceeds, which what that applies to, you can't transfer a homestead. If you're short a homestead and your friend has a house that's not very valuable, you can borrow it or buy it. And not only that, but if you don't have an interest in property, you can't have a homestead because what you're doing is you're making the property. You have a creditor. The other exception is in section Q2, and that's...
So I'm confused now. Let's just back up a minute. Rogers, the Fifth Circuit and Rogers basically reached the same result as the district court in this case. Is that right?
No. The Fifth Circuit and Rogers reached the same result we're asking you to.
Where's what?
We're asking you to.
Right, okay.
The debtor has been ruled against by Judge Sires.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm confused.
None of the cases that we have. Let me talk about that second exception. The $125,000 cap does not apply to the extent the amount of interest is necessary for the support of the debtor. In Nevada, as in most states, you're allowed to exempt property that has commercial uses as long as you live on it. Well, the lead case in Nevada is referred to as Jackman's versus Nance. And that's where they're referred to universally as the gas station. And he was allowed to take both the gas station interest and his own personal interest through the bankruptcy, as long as he didn't exceed the value limit. If you think of a debtor who has Social Security and he lives in the duplex and he has the other part of the duplex, he needs that income, rental income. Again, that's what the Q2 exception is. Again, you're talking about a quantitative exception. If you use the amount of interest for that exception, you could possibly describe the claim of Homestar. So you have a plain meaningful problem if you try to call interest as a homestead. Acquiring the interest is acquiring the homestead. And you also have, for this you need to understand a little bit of history. When Congress created the Bankruptcy Code, in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and it said that the Bankruptcy Code was uniform. What they did to make it uniform is they said the property you can keep through a bankruptcy is determined by state law, meaning the amount of the exemption, and that
So, I mean, this would be helping me a little bit practical here. So, I guess what I need to know is what is the limits of your argument in terms of here you have somebody who owned a piece of property and started to use it as a residence and claimed a homestead in it. They didn't use it as a residence before that. All right, so what if they built a large addition on a house? The house is already there, but they built a large addition on it, and it's now worth more money. What about that? Is that an additional interest?
No, that's an additional interest. Yes, it's an amount that was acquired during the 1215-day period.
Even though it's still the same house, but it's just an add-on to that. I'm sorry?
It's still your homestead throughout the whole period. Under the facts you told me, and they build it on a house, and they ask about you, so it's required to filing. That's what you're asking.
Right. So is that a new interest?
Correct. That's the amount of interest. It's equity in the property. You increase the equity by adding the room. You did not change the fact. It was homestead.
And therefore, it would be subject to the cap.
No, you add... Yes, it will be subject to cap. Sorry. The way you asked it, yes.
So the whole property would now be subject to the cap, or the addition would be subject to the cap?
No.
In other words, what this is intended to deal with is somebody who builds, who buys a whole new house that they didn't have before and tries to homestead it to move all their assets into it, right? That's what the original problem was that this statute dealt with.
Broadly than that, the problem was going from a low exemption state to a high exemption.
Right. Okay.
And the reason.
Well, but it's not limited to moving states. It just isn't. The statute is not on its face limited to moving to a different state.
When they talk about selling a house and buying another.
Yes, that part is. But in general, it's not limited to moving to a different state.
The reason why it's important historically is arguably in a low exemption state, people would loan you more money because, one, what they see you had, you could not take through a bankruptcy and keep without being given.
But it still covers if somebody doesn't own a house at all, say they're renting, and they want to go into bankruptcy, and now they go out and they buy themselves a house and move their assets into the house, the statute still covers it, right? Same state, not a new state. I understand that, but...
And there are adjustments if you pay down the mortgage and therefore buy equity within the 1215 days.
There's exceptions for that. That doesn't count. Okay. But if the person buys a house they didn't have before in the same state, it's covered.
And they then it's capped at 125.
Right. Now, and if they have a little house and they make it a bigger house, that counts. That's also capped. I'm just trying to understand what the limits of this thing.
I've got a $300,000 house, and I sell it, and I take my $300,000 and I buy a $400,000 house. this holding on my $100,000 that I had, they do not count the $300 towards the cap.
They do count the $100,000. They do count the $100,000. But they do count the
$100,000. Yes, but you haven't put it over $125,000 yet.
I understand that.
Okay, but that house is completely exempt. What Green did when he moved on to that property, he didn't add a dime to the value. He spent $14 to record a homestead.
Well, I thought he put a 10 on there.
Well,
or something like.
As I said, I've been somewhat haunted by that. But,
oh, but he.
Or he moved on a trailer.
All right. Doesn't that add to the value of the property?
Not significantly. The trailer was purchased for $1,000 in 1999. It was on the property for some period of time.
What's the difference between moving on a trailer and Judge Berzon's example of, you know, building an add-on to the house?
Well, he hasn't built more than $125,000 of equity. However, if it's not cash, this property is going to be completely exempt because the Nevada homestead is worth $350,000 at the time of filing. The issue is whether we kicked in the cap by his moving on late, even though he didn't take any money from sources creditors yet.
Well, how does that differ from her example about, you know, building an addition? Building an addition.
To get at, and they made it disappear into the house.
So what is it?
All right. So now we have a second issue, which is the appreciation issue. And I had a really hard time understanding the party's position. So could you outline your position that even if Judge Zive was correct about the homestead, still you the appreciation doesn't count, or the opposite, that if he, another see if you can articulate your position.
Wasn't going to hear the appreciation issue because he thought nothing would change the $125,000.
I understand that, but I want to know what if you could state your position in a couple of sentences, what your problem is about the appreciation.
Because the cap applies to an amount of interest acquired by the debtor, passive appreciation doesn't count. There are two types of appreciation. One is the property that you bought way back in goes up in value and keeps going up during the 1215 period. That's not an interest that was acquired by the debtor.
Let me see if I can articulate my problem. Are you assuming your position with regard to the cap or the opposite position with regard to the cap when you discuss the appreciation question?
We believe that the cap is flexible. And what makes it flexible is the cause of the appreciation is whether it was acquired by the debtor or not. I'm hoping I can reserve 2 minutes.
Why don't you finish this now and give you 2 more minutes? Go ahead.
And the appreciation in this case are two. One, he paid down the mortgages by $1,000. Therefore, you acquired property without doing anything extraordinary. Out of the ordinary.
You say there's a statutory exception.
And that makes it $126,000. Two, the property went up in value by an unknown amount because we got chopped off. And that was not property acquired by the debtor because everyone else's house did. And that's what Rasmussen's saying, why that line of cases.
All right. But would you suppose we were to take the opposite position from the one you're arguing for with regard to the cap to begin with?
Then you would still have the appreciation issue.
And you're saying it comes out the same either way. Whatever we think about the cap, the appreciation issue comes out the same either way. Is that what you're saying?
No. If you were to rule in our favor on the Rogers, I'll call the Rogers.
Okay.
As we would hope you would on our favor. Then the appreciation issue is moot because the homestead is $350,000 and the house is.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to understand. So this is only an alternative position if you were to lose on the other issue. Okay. That's what I'm trying to understand.
I'll reserve that 2 minutes.
Thank you.
represent the trustee, Annabelle Savage. My head is spinning a little bit after listening to all the arguments.
I'm sure that if, at least you don't have to decide the cases.
That's true. Regarding Mr. Green's claim of a homestead exemption, the threshold issue, I think, is whether the language of Section 522P is broad enough by the act of moving on to pre-owned property. Unfortunately, we haven't had a previous opportunity to address David Rogers at all, and so this will be my first chance. Rogers is very much on the hook. There's no question. Rogers came to a different conclusion than the bankruptcy court in our case and the district court. Rogers came to the conclusion that under the, what they thought was the plain language of Section 522, it must be acquired during the statutory period is a vested economic interest in the homestead property, not the homestead itself. And this appeal probably, I think, boils down to whether or not you agree with Rogers.
Can I ask a question? One thing that the parties haven't noted, I don't think, is that the statute actually has two provisions. A is real or personal property that the debtor or dependent of the debtor uses as a resident, and the other is real or personal property that the debtor or dependent claims as a homestead. So it seems to treat property used as a resident regardless of whether it's claimed as a homestead.
And I'm not really sure what that refers to, because in our case we're only dealing with the claim of the homestead.
Well, why? But he was using it as a residence, so why isn't it just for that reason? And that's the end of it.
Refer to a federal exemption, and I'm not sure why that's in the statute. Or it might refer to states that allow an exemption for residents, but don't call it a homestead exemption. I'm not sure why that separate provision is in there. In Nevada.
But doesn't that suggest that the homestead itself, the claiming of the homestead, isn't a critical factor, and to call that a separate interest would be fairly peculiar, because then you could just say, all right, fine, I'm not going to claim it as a homestead, I'm just using it as a residence, and I'm claiming it for that reason. I'm claiming it's within the...
In our case, I want to make sure that the distinction is clear. We're not just talking about the claiming of the report, we're talking about the act of acquiring it by assuming the property and taking advantage of the fact that this property was already owned and available.
But your language, your argument depends on the word interest, right? Largely. I'm sorry?
Yes, it does.
All right. And what I'm saying is, doesn't the fact that A is in there as well as D kind of negate the possibility of seeing it as a separate interest? Because certainly the fact that you use something as a residence isn't an interest.
I'm just not sure that that is intended to be read together. I don't know whether or not that's
yes, but it tells you something about what the word interest means.
That's a possible interpretation. I certainly agree with that, but I think you also have to look at the statute as a whole and the policy behind 522. I think everybody agrees that the statute
is very difficult. All right, but the problem is that people write statutes to pursue an interest to a certain degree, and they don't necessarily cover everything that could possibly pursue that interest. And there's a lot of case law saying that. I mean, this certainly looks like a subterfuge around what was intended, but that doesn't mean that it isn't there.
That, I think that's a possible interpretation, but I just don't think that there's any practical reason for distinguishing between debtors who convert cash into homesteads and debtors who convert real property into homesteads. I think in this case we're talking about the conversion of a non-exempt asset into an exempt asset. And I think, you know...
Yeah, at the price of having to live in the house in it, or having to live in a tent or a trailer, yes.
One thing that none of these courts, and Rogers certainly hasn't talked about, is what might have been intended by the language of subsection 522P2B, which is the subsection that allows the debtor to roll over the equity from a principal place, a principal residence acquired before the statutory period. Rogers indicates that its concept of vested economic interest seems consistent with the rollover exemption, But if Rogers is correct, why didn't Congress allow a debtor to roll over equity from a non-residential property owned before the statutory period? And why should an owner of vacant land who transfers his equity to a new homestead property be treated differently than a debtor like Green who converts the same property into a homestead? The effect of the debtor's actions in both cases is identical, and in neither case has the amount of the debtor's so-called vested economic interest changed. Under Rogers, the debtor can claim his exemption by camping out on his vacant land, but not by trading it for a house, and not by buying a house with the proceeds of pre-owned non-residential property. So under the subsection 522P2B, I think Congress plainly didn't want debtors to roll equity from non-residential property owned before the statutory period.
But the problem is that there's no transaction here. There's a person who moved, but there's no transaction. There's no movement of money.
Seems to me that there's...
He could have owned a warehouse and moved into the warehouse, right?
That's correct.
What about the appreciation issue? I really felt that the briefs were passing the night on that. Because, and this is what I was trying to clarify before, and I'm not sure I succeeded, but what I was trying to say is that your brief and the amicus brief seem to take the appreciation issue the opposite way from what I understand the...
I think Mr. Green's claim is that even if Section 522 cap is applicable, he's entitled to the pre-petition appreciation in addition to the $125,000 exemption under Section 522.
Right.
We think that even if the cap is applicable, which we contend that it is, there are three reasons why the district court properly rejected that argument. The district court said you don't get the appreciation in addition to the $125,000 cap. The first reason is that the cap is all the equity in the debtor's property as of the date of the bankruptcy, regardless of whether some of the equity was the result of appreciation. And as you've already heard a little bit today, exemptions are determined as of the date of the bankruptcy without reference to the subsequent changes in the character or value of the exempt property. I don't know if anyone mentioned the case, but In Re Chu, which we cited in our brief, 266 BR 743, Ninth Circuit BAP case. So you look at the exemption as of the date of the bankruptcy. $136,000 cap in Section 522, in effect, allows an exemption of $136,000 with respect to homestead property.
Well, you have to be right, if I understand your point, which is whatever this cap applies to, it has to be at the moment of filing the petition. And that's your basic point.
Yes.
Right. So the fact that he
The total value of the property is as of the date.
Right.
And then there really are two other reasons that go along with that. The second is that regardless of whether pre-petition appreciation is subject to the 522 cap, post-petition appreciation is clearly subject to the cap. And Mr. Green failed to assert or prove that there was any pre-petition appreciation in the bankruptcy court. He should have raised this issue in connection with the trustee's objection to claim of exemption.
He claims that this whole inquiry was cut off because of...
I think the record shows that that's just not the case.
No, it seems that it was the case because the judge said it doesn't matter because he thinks he's already over the cap anyway. It doesn't matter.
Well, no, the judge actually ruled on two independent grounds. He ruled that it was the cap was one, but he also said that there's no way there's any pre-petition appreciation here, because the debtor's schedules showed that the debtor had valued the property at the exact same amount 1 year prior to the date that the bankruptcy was filed, because the debtor actually filed a Chapter 13 originally and then dismissed that, and a year later filed a Chapter 13.
But didn't the judge at some point say, I'm not getting into this because on my theory of the case it doesn't matter?
No, my reading of the record is that he actually made an independent determination that it's based upon the debtor's permission.
Was there any suggestion by the debtor that he wanted to amend the schedule?
No suggestion at all. The debtor didn't even raise the argument concerning pre-petition appreciation until somewhere in the middle of the final hearing on the trustee's motion to sell the property. He should have raised it earlier in connection to the exemption plan, but he didn't raise it at that point. And in fact, even on appeal, there's nothing in the brief where that I've seen where the debtor argues that there's
something. So that issue was sort of decided on sort of like an estoppel point, wasn't it?
Well, I think that's.
Or an admission point.
I think that's one of the reasons. But I, again, as I say, I think there's several.
There was no, you know, hearing on it.
Well, there was no hearing because the debtor never raised the issue.
But if, in fact, the cap doesn't apply otherwise to this property because he just moved on to it and didn't buy it, then why does the pre-petition appreciation? That's different from the question of valuing it at the time, because if there's no cap that applies, there's no cap that applies. So why are we looking at the pre-petition appreciation?
If the cap doesn't apply, and if the court rules with Rogers,
yes.
There's still an open issue that needs to be decided by the bankruptcy court, perhaps, as to whether or not, in the absence of Section 522, the estate is still entitled to the post-petition appreciation of the case.
Now, what about the pre-petition appreciation? You're not arguing for that.
Well, there is. Okay. I don't think there is any pre-petition because that was never raised before, but I think
Well, but you wouldn't care. I mean, if he were right, then you should care about that, not him, right? And so you're basically saying you don't care about any pre-petition appreciation if the cap doesn't apply. In other words, as I understood it, this is why I think the briefs were passing in the night. My understanding of the pre-petition issue is essentially whether somehow or other you could get that any pre-petition appreciation from the time he moved onto the property could be subject to the cap. I don't see why it would be, but that's what I thought the issue was. That's what you
thought. The debtor was claiming that he should be entitled to the pre-petition appreciation.
Right.
But the problem was he never made that contention in the bankruptcy court, and he never attempted to put on any evidence of what was pre-petition appreciation versus post-petition appreciation.
All right, but in concept, you don't disagree that he would be entitled to any pre-petition appreciation. You agree with that? If you were right on that. If he was right about the cap. I'm sorry?
Under 522.
But if he was right about the cap.
Oh, yes.
Okay, then you agree.
And I would agree. Yes.
All right. So then. Okay.
That we're entitled to appreciation.
And then the question is, has anybody figured that out?
Correct.
Okay.
I may have covered most of the important points. I would, again, point out that I think that the subsection does indicate that there was an intent that the debtor only be allowed to use principal place of residence owned outside of the 1,215-day period. And I would also...
didn't he claim this was his principal place of residence?
Pardon me?
Didn't he claim this was his principal place of residence?
Well, it wasn't a principal place of residence outside the 1,200.
No, I understand that.
It only became that 2 weeks before the filing of the bankruptcy. But I also think that Section 522P, as I've argued in my brief, seems to be geared towards the debtor's exemption at the time when they filed the bankruptcy. If you look at Schedule C, which is a form that debtors are required to file with the bankruptcy petition in order to comply with their burden to claim exemptions, it's entitled Property Claimed as Exempt. It goes on to provide that as a result of the election, the debtor may not exempt any amount of interest acquired within Section 522 provides that the debtor may not exempt any amount of interest acquired within the statutory period. The phrase claims as a homestead in Section 522B1D to me logically refers to the claim of exemption made in Schedule C. It therefore seems logical to conclude that the term amount of interest was intended to refer to the monetary value of the claim of exemption and not to some amount of interest that was acquired prior to the debt.
Okay, thank you very much.
On the property August 1st, 2004. There were two bankruptcies that he did not proceed with. So he lived on this property for 2 years, and he moved on to a year and approximately a year and 15 days prior, I mean, a year and 2 months prior to this case. The quote from Judge Zeig speaking, it's the first hearing in the second volume of the appendix at page 275-276. It does not matter what the value of the property is, because it's never going to be more than $125,000 on the date of the petition. So the value of the property itself doesn't matter. That's when we trump it. And
He had earlier ruled essentially as was described. My understanding is that he did, but then you came, I'm sorry, just a minute, that you then came in and asked to present further evidence after he had indicated that there, in his view there was no appreciation, and that's when he said it doesn't matter. You sure did before.
I'll sink or swim. If you read it, I'll sink and swim on what you feel. It's the first hearing in the second volume of the appendix. The written decision, which doesn't mention the value at all, is immediately after it.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Very complicated and interesting. And thank you for your arguments. And your case, Green v. Savage, is submitted. And we are finally concluded for the day and for the week. Thank you very much.